Welcome today to our interview series with the world's top outstanding professionals and innovators. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Simon Dixon, co-founder, CEO, author of Bank to the Future, a global top-ranking innovation leader and entrepreneur. Simon, with your amazing background, thank you for sharing your experiences with our audience.
No worries.
Now, Simon, can you profile your prior top roles and useful lessons from those roles, again, in consideration of all the things that you've done?
Yeah, so my career, as I came out of university, there was nothing more that I wanted to do than to work in investment banking or finance. And the problem was I couldn't get a job. So I still remember I've got 96 rejection letters from all the different investment banks and financial institutions that I was applying to at the time. And I remember my careers advisor telling me I wasn't educated enough. So I went and did a master's in economics and then got rejected from 125 of them. So after doing that, I kind of changed my approach and I knocked on the door of a company in Manchester called TD Waterhouse. And that was a stockbroker's, one of the largest ones in Canada. And I left with a job as a T-boy. And after 1 month of being a T-boy, I was a stockbroker. And after 6 months of doing that, I was a trader as a market maker for an investment bank in the London Stock Exchange. And after 2 years of doing that, I was a corporate financier working with venture capitalists that wanted to take their investment companies public on the stock exchange. I remember meeting lots of very successful CEOs that were taking their companies public. And I decided I was on the wrong side of the desk. So after a short career in corporate finance, I quit my job and set up a qualification company for investment bankers. And I was fortunate enough to, after about a year of doing that, get that angel funded by a billionaire in the UK called Peter Hargreaves, who founded a company called Hargreaves Lansdown. And therein began my whole education in the world of business and finance. And I wrote a book on the future of banking called Bank to the Future. And as the financial crisis got worse and worse, I was discussing topics like Bitcoin and crowdfunding and alternative finance. So as the crisis got worse, it became more topical. I set up a crowdfunding company called BankToTheFuture.com. And Bank to the Future is a regulated equity crowdfunding platform that allows people to invest in companies and businesses, raise finance through alternative means. So I've kind of been on the same path in many different shapes of, and sizes. And I guess the common theme has always been around investing and raising finance for businesses, whether it be public offerings or venture capital or angel investing or setting up businesses or crowdfunding. I was lucky enough to really figure out my focus in life, but I just didn't know exactly what it looked like. So I've now arrived at the place where I'm a director of the UK Crowdfunding Association and the UK Digital Currency Association, working with alternative finance and right time, right place, a bit of luck, and it's an extremely booming area at the moment while the financial crisis makes the traditional financial sector smaller and smaller.
Well, Simon, you definitely are a innovation leader in the finance area and recognized as such globally. And as you mentioned, you're an author, in fact, a best-selling author. So from that perspective, what do you see as the future of banking?
Well, I think what we're going to see, there's kind of three changes that need to happen in banking, in the world of banking and finance at the moment. The first is you've got the traditional banks, the big banks as we know it. Now, in my book, I discussed about three things that need to be reformed and three changes. The first is that when you deposit your money with a bank, they become the legal owner of your money. The second is that when they become the legal owner of your money, they spend it and allocate it as they wish through how they issue loans. And what happens with that is in the UK anyway, I can speak for the UK banking sector because I know it well, about 40% of it goes to property speculation, which is pushing up property prices, which is unproductive, inflationary asset growth which adds no value and not many jobs to society. The other 40% goes to financial speculation, which makes the financial sector richer, but the rest of the world poorer. And only about 13% goes to small to medium-sized businesses, which actually create jobs, which is productive growth. So the problem is with banks allocating money is they allocate it in the wrong place, and the rest is consumer loans and large companies. So that needs to be reformed. Until then, we'll have a collapse of our banking system as we know it, because unfortunately that system only perpetuates debt and a nation who is continually getting ever increasing deeper into debt. So those are top-down changes which government needs to make. In the absence of that, entrepreneurs have done amazing things, like invented digital currencies like Bitcoin, which are actually sustainable banking. And in the future, that's going to be more and more interesting. The other two reforms I discussed about is that banking needs to be split up from large banks to lots and lots of local banks with local knowledge. The best country for that in the world is Germany, which has 7,000 local banks, and much more money gets distributed to the productive side of the economy rather than the speculative side of the economy. And the third one is a stimulation of what I call ideological-based finance. By ideological, I mean local banking is more like geographical-based finance, where it serves the local community. Ideological is like crowdfunding, where essentially a group of people get together with a shared ideology and tend to meet online and fund each other. And the importance of that is that there's no financial institution in the middle. And when there's no financial institution in the middle, you tend to get what gets funded reflects the values of society. So once you have these three changes of top-down reforms of the banking system, which have come about by a crisis which needs fixing, bottom-up innovation from entrepreneurs creating digital currencies like Bitcoin, which is banking how it's meant to be and how it can be today, more localized banking rather than large banking demergers, and then really the deinstitutionalization and disintermediation of finance through crowdfunding and peer-to-peer lending and various other inventions that are coming today, you have sustainable finance finally. And it seems that if there was one blessing that came out of the financial crisis, you got all these bottom-up inventions from entrepreneurs, which are working to make our financial system more sustainable. So I'm very positive about the future, but we need to recognize our problems and we need to fix them.
Wow, that's you gave us so many insights. It's clear of your global expertise in this area. In terms of your past experiences, how did they lead to your work with funding and crowdfunding?
Well, as both an entrepreneur and by my corporate career, I've always been involved in raising finance. And essentially, finance, in its simplest form, is very simple. It's people that have money that wish to receive a return on that money being put together with people that need money, that can do something with it, whether it's buy a house or create a business. And in the middle of that, lots of different products exist, and they've got extremely complex as financial innovation has evolved. But really, finance is a very simple concept. So everything I've been involved with is really creating products in the corporate finance career or the trading career that redistribute and allocate money towards different means. And when I was in business, I've been in scenarios where I've needed access to capital and found it very hard to get hold of. In other times, I've been in scenarios where I've got excess capital and I'd like to invest it and get a return on it. And where that fits in with crowdfunding is that we're kind of moving to an environment where you've got, you know, entrepreneurs funding other entrepreneurs, people with different ideologies funding other people with the same similar ideology. My background's always been involved in this relocation. But now when I saw crowdfunding emerge, I thought finally the technology and the environment has reached a place where we can actually allocate resources without necessarily a financial institution sitting in the middle that cares more about profit than the mission of what's actually being funded in the case of the business.
Now, you've created this amazing platform, Bank to the Future. Can you overview this creation and why people should get involved?
So Bank to the Future is essentially a platform where entrepreneurs and businesses can pitch their businesses to other people. And investors can get involved at different levels, whether that be a small investment of £10 to a larger investment of £100,000. It's all inclusive to everybody. So the major part of Bank to the Future, the original vision, was to democratize investing, which has some challenges in terms of regulations, as we've experienced over the years, and also encourage financial inclusion, whereby people can get in, you know, start diversifying and build a portfolio in companies, and do that with as little as £10, £100, £1,000 in the case of the UK. So Bank to the Future is, if you log into Bank to the Future, essentially, you can invest in companies, and it's great. You can start small. And businesses apply for finance with us, and we do some online incubation where we help them get their business ready for investors. Well, you know, that involves valuing their company, pitching their company, writing business plans. And once they're fully investment ready, the crowd then decide whether they like the business or not by whether they invest or not. And we leave it over to the crowd as opposed to the financial appetite of just rich people or venture capitalists.
Now, the marketplace is still relatively new in terms of your platform, Bank to the Future, but there are some platforms in other countries. So how would you differentiate yourself from the others?
So we differentiate in a number of ways. Firstly, because my last business was delivering online training at scale, we've taken it upon ourselves that we think the success of our platform in the future is dependent upon the quality of businesses pitching on our site. And by quality, I mean, you know, pitches that people can agree with or disagree with, whether they like or not, but they're pitched well, they're presented well, and people, you know, investors can really see the information presented in the best light of the business. So we spend a lot of time with that. And at the moment, we've got, I think, the only process that's scalable to deliver that, because we've got a lot of experience with that from my last business. We, you know, one of our training programs was delivered to about 10,000 people, at scale, and, that passed and graduated from it, all done online. The second is that we're what we call a hybrid model. For those of you new to crowdfunding, this may sound a bit geeky, but there's kind of different models of crowdfunding. One model is that you put a pitch on a site, and you offer rewards to people. And by rewards, it could be some non-monetary reward, for example, your product. So maybe if everyone's heard of Kickstarter, an amazing rewards-based crowdfunding site, where people offer their products to people and people donate, and if the sum's reached, they get it. There's also equity crowdfunding, which is like in the UK we have a show called Dragon's Den. So it's like an online Dragon's Den where you pitch to investors, but anyone can be an investor. You also have what's called debt-based crowdfunding, which is essentially lending money, to businesses. And you can receive interest on your money even by starting small and diversifying across lots of businesses. What we do at Bank to the Future is we've spent many years working on how you integrate those three models into one product. And so people offer rewards, or they can invest for either equity and later debt. So we're a unique platform in that sense, both from investors can diversify and invest in different ways, and businesses can get real good support to pitch their businesses in a good way. So that's kind of where we distinguish ourselves at the moment, and we've got some very ambitious plans for the future too.
I mean, that's an amazing platform to be a hybrid of those three different tiers in essence. I can see that will contribute quite a bit to your success. So those are some of the factors in your success. Can you name others that you think will be essential for your resounding success?
Well, for the company, I mean, the aspirations of what we want to do, I talked about earlier a bit about my ideology of what the future of banking looks like. Well, Bank for the Future is really a manifestation of the ideology. And we've got a great team that was built around us. We were fortunate when we launched to get the support of Sir Richard Branson. And we've got some people that have been instrumental in the world of new banks and alternative finance that have joined us. And what we want to do as we grow is really take a lot of the elements of banking and put it into the new way of doing things. So one step at a time, and this isn't an overnight mission, but one step at a time, we're building what we eventually want to be, a crowd investment bank. And I'd say the reason that we differentiate ourselves is we're a team of people that really, really care, on a big mission to make a difference. And, you know, we've all been involved in this world of alternative finance since its birth. And, you know, for us, the success of alternative and finance is way more important than, you know, just necessarily making a large profit or anything like that. So we consider ourselves ideologists and missionaries at the same time as having a group of very experienced business people with a track record of execution.
You know, from the marketplace itself, you definitely have the most flexible platform, and you indicated that there's some big announcements coming up into the future. Are you able to talk about some of that in terms of how your work will evolve, let's say, in the next 5 years?
I can't give you the specifics. The only reason I say that is because we're in a very competitive marketplace. Whenever we say that we're going to do something, everybody gets away at trying to develop it faster. So we like to surprise the market a little bit. All I can say is that we're building a crowd investment bank, and we're building it one product at a time. And over the coming months and years, we'll be releasing the fundamental principle and belief that we're buying into is that in the future, every single financial product, whether it be mortgages, insurance, whatever it may be, fund, will be deinstitutionalized and based upon people funding it in a peer-to-peer crowdfunded relationship. So at Bank for the Future, in various different ways, we want to be a part of the reinvention of banking from the ground up. And there's several different parts to that, that we're making sure we've got divisions or we're investing in companies that are doing that. And we want to make sure that it's all kind of integrated nicely, built from the ground up, a bit like an iPhone rather than clunking together bits of different technology. We really focus on making sure there's seamless integration.
Now, I think you've touched on this already somewhat, but do you believe that crowdfunding will then supplement traditional funding approaches or really be totally disruptive and significantly replace traditional funding approaches?
I think alternative finance will definitely do some disruption. But we have to remember that, you know, banks don't really like lending to business. So when an alternative finance house comes along and does something to lend to business, you know, that's not too bad. But when companies come along and start doing things which banks really care about, like mortgages, and that's done through crowdfunding, that's going to be very disruptive. I think in the future, the traditional incumbents, venture capitalists, traditional financial institutions, they won't take crowdfunding as serious as it should be. And the reason that they won't get involved too much as well is because our model is a lot less profitable than their model. Doing what banks do is a lot more profitable. So they don't have an incentive to try and support the sector or get involved in the sector because it kind of is a better way, cheaper way, and less profitable way of doing what they've done for a long time. I do think that new people along and kind of dress themselves up as crowdfunding, but there'll be fake crowdfunding platforms where the money comes from institutions, and banks, and therefore it takes out the fundamental principles of disintermediation. But the most disruptive alternative finance, more than crowdfunding, is actually digital currencies, which are actually the biggest invention since the internet, in my opinion. So that's extremely disruptive. And when you have digital currencies meeting inventions like crowdfunding and peer-to-peer lending, you have a significant problem for the future of traditional financial institutions, which are going to have to adapt over the years.
Now, you have one of the most flexible platforms on the planet, and with Bank to the Future. So what's your global strategy? For example, what if people in other countries want to use your platform? What are the challenges, or what are the opportunities?
Well, the technical challenges aren't that significant because we've already built our platform in a way where it can handle multi-currencies, multi-different payment methods. The regulatory challenges are significant because it took us 2 years to create the correct regulatory environment in the UK to be able to offer shares to investors. To put it in perspective, before equity crowdfunding and our work that we did lobbying, it was punishable by a 7-year prison sentence to pitch someone your business that wasn't rich in the UK. We had to change all those rules. Now, each country has their own rules and their own regulatory environment. For us, it's fairly easy and seamless to expand to Europe. But, you know, and then you've got two different challenges. You've got the businesses raising finance, and you've also got the investors, and there's different rules. So for us to expand to a country like America or some countries in Asia, you have to take their regulatory environment one at a time. So, it's significant, it's challenging, but, you know, we do have aspirations to, really, just kind of give a demonstration to regulators that we live in a different environment today. We live in a global environment, we live in an open environment, and one of the most important regulators of today is not necessarily, the actual central authority that's regulating the financial institutions. But one of the most important regulators today is Twitter and Facebook and LinkedIn, because people care about their online reputations today, and companies care about their online reputation. And regulators find it very challenging to adapt to those environments, because most people that work for regulatory institutions aren't even on Twitter.
Now, there's a recent change within China. In August of 2013, the Chinese central government launched a program for financial market openness, and that program is expanding and continuing. Do you see yourself tying in or being able to leverage that in terms of your platform? And can you provide forecasts where you feel this will lead and its implications?
So at the moment, we're focused on English-speaking countries just because of the, you know, kind of the rapport with the platform. Whether we expand countries in China, they're not things we're exploring at the moment. It's an almighty market. And to be honest, not a market I know too much in terms of regulations and the financial system. So, I haven't got too much to comment on, about that because it's not an area I've had much experience of. But any movement towards financial openness, is to be encouraged today because we're in a very changing world today.
Now, you've been involved in terms of some of the policy changes in the UK. What additional investment policy changes would you like to see in your country and, in fact, worldwide?
Well, one of the things that I'd like to see is a recognition that we live in a global environment today, and it's very silly to say that only US investors can invest in US companies or UK investors can only invest in UK companies. The world doesn't work like that anymore. If you look across Facebook and people's connections and social media and the internet, you can't categorize like you used to. So I don't necessarily know the answer to how this is going to happen. But there needs to be a recognition that we live more in a transparent world, and we also live more in a global world. In terms of the changes, one of the big changes that we were a part of was firstly opening up who can invest in private companies. So typically investing in private companies is a very high risk, high return asset class. But it came to the point where equity crowdfunding said, well, now people can invest £10. And when it was illegal for not necessarily a rich person to invest £10 in companies, it begged the question of, well, why are people allowed to gamble and bet £10, but they're not allowed to invest in companies and build their assets and create jobs and do positive stuff? So it caused lots of conflict and interest, and we were involved in changing those rules. One of the other things is that the other changes that I'd like to see is an environment where companies can invest in other companies and receive some of the tax incentives because you want to remember that when people are investing, they have choices of what to do with their money. They can invest in property, or they can invest in something like a business or a stock market. And because this is a riskier asset class, we need to encourage people to invest in this, because this is where most growth occurs. So therefore, any incentives that could drive more investment in this asset class is good things. And those in the UK were done through tax incentives. And I'd love to see more incentives for companies to invest in other companies as well.
Now, Simon, as this globally recognized leader, best-selling author, investment expert, you have this amazing platform that you've created. From all of that experience, do you have any stories you want to share, perhaps from your speaking travels and work? Maybe something amusing, surprising, unexpected, or amazing?
Cool. That's a interesting question. I think one of the most important things is that, look, you've said some very kind and positive things about me, and you'd be forgiven for thinking from this interview that I've achieved a lot of things like I want to achieve, but I've failed way more things than achieved. And it's very easy to think that when you look at people that might have achieved the things you want, that it's been an easy journey. But life is a very challenging journey. It's full of failures. And really, one of the main things that I've learned is to go out there, do the best you can, really try and achieve something, and recognize that there's going to be lots of rejection along the way. Rejection is actually an instrumental part of failing your way to success. And all the successful people that I've met or known have just simply failed so many times that they've got to where they want to go. And I remember an example, one of my early journeys in trying to work and get promoted in investment banking is I remember reading a book by a gentleman called Les Brown, and it's called Live Your Dreams. And he told me about how he got a job, one of his first jobs he built through persistence. And I actually replicated his strategy with one of my directors at the time. So I was a T-boy and I wanted to be a stockbroker. And I remember knocking on the door saying I wanted a job as a stockbroker. He told me to go away. And so I knocked on the door the next day and did the same thing and said, I want to be a stockbroker. Has anyone quit since yesterday? And he said, no one's quit since yesterday. And I went away. And then on the third time, I did the same thing. I knocked on the door and said, I want a job as a stockbroker. Is there any jobs? And he said, no, I told you yesterday there's no jobs. I said, I just want to check if anyone's died since yesterday. And he found it very funny and actually gave me a job in that moment because he believed that I had the persistence and skills that would be required to be good in the job. The moral of the story is life is full of rejection, fail your way to success, expect things to be hard. The point of life, really, to me, is reaching a point where you're so passionate about something that effort becomes effortless, not that things get easy because things... achieving anything you want in life is really hard.
You know, that's a great story. And in fact, I was smiling as you were, going in for that last time and you got the job. Just some great lessons there. Now, we're down to our last question, and I know you're very tight for time because you're just so much in demand. But this is where I sort of reverse the position here and by asking you, like, if you were conducting this interview, what questions would you ask and then what would be your answers?
Very interesting question. I'd probably ask some of the questions that you've already asked about the future of finance, because I'm a finance geek like that. You've already covered those. But I think like a closing question, let me think of something that sounds that ends this in the right way. I guess it's a question about how you remain focused, because, you know, there's so many setbacks in life, and it's often easy to get distracted by opportunity. And the question I'd ask is, I've never actually been distracted by opportunity. I've always remained focused. So one of the observations that I've made in life is that, the people that tend to struggle is, rather than chasing passion, they tend to chase opportunity, and they tend to find opportunities, which are, a good way to make money or a good way to do something. But what I found is that good ways to make money aren't necessarily what you're paying, and people don't do well at them. So rather than chasing opportunity, I'd encourage you all to chase your passion. And when you chase your passion, which is what I've done, you kind of go down a path in life where effort becomes effortless. You find where you want to fit in. And that's what I'd encourage everyone to do, chase your passions rather than opportunities.
That's a very valuable insight and lesson to pass on to the audience. So, Simon, I know your schedule is demanding, and we are indeed fortunate to have you come in and do the interview. So thank you for sharing your many deep experiences with our audience.
Thank you for having me. I always like talking about things to help someone else, and I hope there were some gems and nuggets in there for you.
Indeed, there are many gems and nuggets for our audience, and I want to close by saying I'm Stephen Ibaraki. And this concludes our exclusive interview with Simon Dixon, co-founder, CEO, author of Bank to the Future, a globally top-ranking innovation leader and an entrepreneur.